Welcoming in, to begin hour two, our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, sir.
Timberlicious.
That is I, indeed. Glad to see you got yourself some new kicks.
My shoes, right?
Yeah.
After 6 years, my old shoes, I was like someone in a Steinbeck novel, traveling west, walking a lot, getting a ride when they can. Those, are you allowed to say hobo anymore? But they were hobo shoes. Like I was one of those migrant workers, pick a bale of cotton, pick a bale of hay.
Well, particularly with the mileage you put on, yeah, you need that.
But, well, I don't really use those shoes for, those are, you have to realize there are different standards in my world. These would be like yard work shoes for you, but in my world, those are fancy shoes. I use the sneakers for all the other stuff, but I eviscerate sneakers. I rip the back out of them. They do not last very long at all. Makes me wonder if I walk the wrong way.
I do the same thing. Either if I can get sneakers to last 6 months, I'm doing something right. And I'm not even a Zulu apprentice.
that's something to aspire to. But yeah, the backs go. The backs go pretty quickly, and then the sides start to split. But I have flat feet, so I also have to like wedge in there the arch supports. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Right. I pay that price. But I guess if it was back in the day, I could not have served our country and the army. I would have had to be like a clerical sort of guy.
Well, let's talk about so many topics to cover today, but let's start with this impressive feat that the blog, Many Moments More, has reached quite a milestone, 1,000 blog entries. My goodness.
That's a lot. And remember when you said, you'll never get there, you'll succumb first. I was like, Kimball, have some faith in the Sea Dog. So. And you know what, Downtownian? I am going to chide all of you because with this website, it has this horrible analytics component. It tells me things I don't want to know, oftentimes about crazy people out there in random towns, people I used to know who are like stalking me and reading the blog at all hours, that kind of thing. But I have learned, despite all of our plugs of this unique journal on this show, there are all of three people. You're one of them, Mr. Kimball, in all of Bangor who have gone to this website in the last month. Surely we can do better than that, people. I come on here. It's not as price. I don't get paid the big bucks that you think. I did a rough computation today, Kimball. I have been on this air with you for 60 hours out of my life. Surely we can go to the blog. The blog is there for all of you. It's a great work of art. Great work of inspiration. And yes, 1,000 entries. So what that means is it's longer than all of the journals that Thoreau wrote, all of Samuel Pepys's diaries, and all of Proust's In Search of Lost Time, this unique record of the human experience.
I hope we're not giving people too much of a good thing here with the, well, let's be honest, the best 60 hours that we've had on the show. I would hope that would encourage them. But, you know, they say you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them think.
Yeah, I don't buy that. Come on. I know we got the horses out there, people.
All right. Go to the blog. Many Moments More. Go to the website, ColinFlemingLit.com. It's going to make you a better person. How many times do I have to tell you people that? And you might, on the blog, among other things, because you'll see a variety of topics, you might see Colin talk sports, which he does as well as anybody around, including the assertion that Wade Boggs, Hall of Famer, though he be, may be underrated. How is that possible?
It was actually on this day, coincidental, I didn't plan it this way, in 1982, that Wade Boggs got the first of his 3,010 hits, so that's pretty cool. But Boggs, if you go through his stats, they're really surprising. Like, for instance, 1987 was a big offensive year in baseball. Do you remember that? Like, the ball flying out of ballparks, and it was after, like, home runs had been down. It's kind of similar to 1977, because in 1976, I think Craig Nettles led the American League with, like, 32 home runs. But
right.
Boggs had his big power year. In 1987, he actually led the league in OPS, on-base percentage plus slugging. He got over 1,000 that year, which you'd never expect from Wade Boggs, right?
Well, that was the year he hit 24 home runs, too.
It was, but here's the really fascinating stats. He leads the league in OPS again the next year. He has 5 home runs in 58 RBI. Have you ever heard of a player who wasn't playing in like 1911 who led the league in OPS with power numbers like that? It is one of the strangest modern stats you will ever see. You won't see anything like it now. Like, if you have those kind of power numbers, you won't be in the top, like, 50 for OPS. You have to be somewhere around 1,000, and you'll have 42 home runs. But even when he went to the Yankees, and my impression as a kid, like, in real time, was that Boggs was pretty much done by then. He had had his greatness and everything. He goes to the Yankees, and he's finishing, like, 4th in the league in batting average. He wins 2 silver sluggers. He wins 2 gold gloves. He was still one of the elite players in the game after he left the Red Sox. Now, it wasn't like he got gypped out of an MVP or anything like that, but Wade Boggs might have been the best player of the 1980s. He was that good, and he had this reputation, ironically, of being this selfish player. Do you remember that? He takes too many walks.
Right.
But now that tide has turned completely, and he would be viewed as, oh, he's such a team guy, always getting on base.
7 straight 200-hit seasons. I don't know if we'll see that again for a while. And hit over 300 in 14 of his first 15 years in the majors.
200-hit seasons can be misleading because, like, Ted Williams never had a 200-hit season. He walks so much.
Right.
So a lot of free swingers who are good hitters can get 200-hit seasons. 200-hit season is very difficult to get when you're an on-base guy. There's like a correlation between the two. When you're walking, it's robbing you of that chance to ground the single up the middle kind of thing, which was a Wade Boggs speciality. So for him to have 200 hits all those times, and his career, too, started strangely late. I don't know what the Red Sox were thinking at the time. Maybe you were on the premises, like in Florida, when he was doing his spring training thing. But I don't think Boggs became sort of a full-time guy until he was like 24, because I remember, like, you'd get these, like, Beckett baseball card monthly magazines when I was a kid. I was following all of that stuff, and it would sort of handicap future Hall of Famers, or who had chances and what your chances were, that kind of thing. And it was like 87, 88, 89. It was like, oh, too bad Boggs got started relatively late because that cost him his chance at 3,000 hits. Now, he hung around long enough to get to the 3,000 hits with Tampa, the Devil Rays at the time, but he was dominant. He was the best player on those Red Sox teams in the 1980s. Your guy, Dwight Evans, Jim Rice, Boggs was the best player. He's leading the league in war. In like the next year, I think that was in 88, he was first in war. 87, he was second. And he was this guy who didn't have like a ton of pop. It was because his power was doubles power.
Right,
it was a beautiful thing to watch, especially at Fenway Park.
And a career on-base percentage of .415.
Yes, I just think on-base percentage is one of those stats where, to me, the most amazing baseball stat of all time is not something Ruth did or Hank Aaron did or anything like that. It's that Ted Williams practically had a 50% on-base percentage for his career. That's insane. Mm. Think about that. It's not like Little League. Someone goes up, and half the time they're going to at least reach first base. That's almost troubling how high that is. And the numbers came down by the time Boggs was doing his thing. But he was an on-base machine, and the runs scored. Look at that column on Baseball Reference. It's like century mark, century mark, century mark. He was a machine. And the knock on him was that he was selfish, that he didn't try to drive the ball. There's an episode of Cheers. Remember when he was on it?
Yes.
They don't think that it's Boggs. And Clavin, of course, is leading that charge. He's like, Wade Boggs is a big strapping guy like myself. And he was playing off that idea that if he wanted to, Boggs could hit home runs, but he would pepper that wall instead. And when he came up, I remember like in 83, he was pretty lousy as a defender. Painful to watch him at third base. He worked himself into that elite level defender later on in his career.
He's also, and I don't, there's no statistic for this, but from my recollection, nobody I've seen in my 50-plus years of watching baseball had the ability Boggs had to foul off pitches that he didn't like.
I pitched that to ESPN once, if it was possible. to do a piece on the art of the foul ball. Now, in Ted Williams' autobiography, My Turn at Bat, he talks about this drunk in right field that he didn't like. And he's like, I handled the pitcher pretty well. So he's trying to line shots
right.
at this guy out there, like purposely, foul balls. But Boggs could spoil a pitch. And it's just like, that's a split inch, right? Mm. It's such a small amount of acreage of the bat. How do some guys manage to do that? How is it like never this number back to the pitcher? It's one of the most inexplicable skills. And the hand-eye coordination, I was writing on this blog today, about Bo Jackson being, I think, the most overrated athlete in history by far. I think he was average at one sport and slightly above average in another sport. He was just this brawn guy who would kind of run into the ball as a power hitter in baseball. Never close to that level of athleticism to me. I think that's athleticism, hand-eye coordination, to spoil pitches like Boggs could spoil. And then he'd just smoke one, take the ball the other way over the shortstop's head, and he was back on base.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown, from baseball to hockey and the Boston Bruins. And you think there are at least a couple of current Bruins who will end up in the Hall of Fame. I was going through the roster and looking. Let's see how I do compared to you. I would say Patrice Bergeron and maybe Tuukka Rask is the second one.
Oh, you're a surprising guy, Kimball, and I hate to say this, but you're also a wrong guy.
All right, then maybe Marchand would have been my third.
I'm actually, I'll have to reconsider. I thought you would be pretty bang on sometimes, Kimball. Just because I underrate you in some areas doesn't mean I don't overrate you in others. Bergeron, but Marchand is, he's a slam dunk. He could retire right now. He's going to be a Hall of Fame player. He's going to be the first line all NHL left wing this year. Once you get two or three of those, unless you have an injury truncated career, you're on your way. He's been the Bruins' best player, and they've had some very good players. But for the last like 5 years, he's the best player on that team. He's efficient to dominant in all three zones. He carries that top line, and he is becoming one of the best left wings. Now, I know it's a weak position throughout the history of the league, but he is becoming one of the best left wings in the history of the NHL. And I think he's someone whose game, after the fact, is going to look so much more impressive to people. He is morphed. He's had such a strange career. I wrote about this for Sports Illustrated when he was starting to go from like third line guy. Part of that was Claude Julien was holding him back. He wasn't getting power play time, but he was always producing even strength to getting those first line minutes. But he was a goal scorer at first. Then he morphed. He became a playmaker. Now, you might say, oh, what's that? It's a big deal. Is a wing being a playmaker? It's a strange thing. Playmakers are almost always centers or even defensemen. But they're rarely wings. Wings are out there to score goals. Then when the team needs him to snipe again, like this year, he's more of a goal scorer again. He is dynamic in his own end. He is a fantastic hockey player. So those two, I think Bergeron is, again, himself overrated, but he'll get in. And then I think you have two guys with Hall of Fame talent. Doesn't mean their careers are going to be Hall of Fame careers. And that would be Pastrnak and McAvoy. And then as for your man, Tuukka Rask, why, Kimball, to put you on the spot, do you think he's a Hall of Famer?
Well, he's got pretty good numbers. Was it 2.27 per game average? Impressive save percentage. He's racked up in, was it well over 300 wins in his career? And he's been, if our qualifier is he one of the best in the league during his time? He's certainly up there in the top three or four, I would think, year in and year out.
I would say that his career stats don't really mean a lot. They're kind of like NFL quarterback career stats right now. If you look at guys, for instance, in the NFL, like the all-time completion percentage, that kind of thing, you will see a lot of guys who suck on that list, who just aren't very good. It's partially because of the era they play in. And then you'll see like Joe Montana and Dan Marino behind these guys. So right now, save percentage is a lot different than what it was when, if you had a 90 save percentage, you were considered like all world. You could win the Vezina with like an 89 Grant Fuhr save percentage. So if you actually look where he ranks with his stats, his career stats, They're going to help him, but they're not going to make the case. He does not have a Stanley Cup. People will think he will. He does. But he doesn't have his name on that cup at all. He didn't play a minute in that postseason with Tim Thomas. He has the one Vezina, and he defecated the bed in the final series a couple years ago. So I think it's very simple for how Tuukka Rask gets in. He is going to need one of the three. Stanley Cup, Conn Smythe, second Vezina. Get one of the three, he's in. Get none of the three, he's not in. And don't forget, Mr. Kimball, there is no harder position in all of professional sports in which to make your Hall of Fame than it is for an NHL goaltender. They do not let goaltenders in. They have a completely different criteria for goaltenders that you don't get with the other positions in any sport.
I was looking at some of the goaltender stats, and I had forgotten because he was around so long. He just was so much a part of the fabric of the game for so many years. But good Lord, 691 career wins for Martin Brodeur. That's insane.
He had the perfect system, too, though. I think that hurts him. I think I'm one of the few people who consider Brodeur a better goalie than Dominik Hasek. On the theme of overrated, I think Hasek was wildly overrated. He was a postseason, not a liability, but you know who Hasek reminds me of in a different sport is Pedro Martinez. Just great in the regular season, but not really the guy, with the exception of that one game against Cleveland when he came in relief,
right,
who'd bring it for you in the postseason. And when he won his championship, he wasn't the guy. He was a passenger-type guy, and Hasek was that when he gets to the Red Wings, and they're just loaded with players. But then you have just weird goaltender selections, too. I know he's like a Boston guy, but Jerry Cheevers, kind of a strange guy to have in there, and don't forget, Tom Barrasso's not in.
Right.
Barrasso comes out of high school, wins the Vezina. He wins a couple cups. Like, you normally need either, like, lots of hardware or you need multiple cup runs. And multiple cup runs aren't enough. Like, Mike Vernon will not get in. And Tim Thomas has the hardware easily. And I'd so much rather have Thomas than Rask in the winner take. I mean, it's not even close. And he doesn't have Rask's career numbers. So he's light there, but Rask has those, and if he gets one of and he would have gotten the Conn Smythe and the Cup a couple years ago. He was phenomenal in those playoffs, and they get to the final game, and he just was a puddle. And in that last game, what was it? They scored on their first four shots against him? Like, you just can't. That's not going to get you to the Hockey Hall of Fame.
All right, let's shift gears and talk about another great episode of the wonderful radio series, yours truly, Johnny Dollar. This one, one of the half-hour episodes from November of 1956, The Markham Matter. Very entertaining episode.
We've transitioned, and I've sort of like prefaced this to you, I think, when I've mentioned these episodes, that the half-hour ones are, they're nowhere near as good as those five-part
I agree. Episodes,
which is, at the same time, that's like damning with faint criticism. Because those 13 months worth of five barters are, to me, the absolute gold standard in all of radio-dom, and certainly mid-century radio. But this is one of the first episodes after the five-parters concluded. So you get this kind of runoff from the five-part episode. So you probably noticed that some of the hallmark, the lingering on certain details of the five-part episodes are still present in this episode. Now, if I had sent you one, or you'll hear it on your own, from 2 years after this, you'll hear how much more pacey it is, and they don't linger over these details. But the plot for this one is Dollar goes out to, what's it, California, and he is going to, he meets with this insurance broker, and this woman who is 40 years old is not getting some check or paying some premium, that type of thing. And Dollar goes out to the house to investigate, and it turns out that she's being doped up by her husband, who is trying to finagle his way into her money and has this office romance going on with this pretend secretary for his pretend business. But it's not the plot that makes this episode so great. It's the interaction. It's the lingering on details. It's the relationship between Dollar and the insurance broker, who who lives this pedestrian sort of life, and he gets caught up in Dahler's world in being this de facto apprentice investigator, to use your term from before. And his name is Ed Porden, and he likes when Dahler calls him Eddie. Like it's like fast ignorant Dahler type thing. But there's just the writing to me when Dahler goes to the house and he meets this guy, Markham, this cad, and Markham walks away from him. You notice the phrase that Dahler says in the little swirl of his exit? Like he picks up the note of his cologne and he can tell that this guy likes fancy, expensive things, but the little swirl of his exit, that's the perfect phrase for that kind of like walk away move that people do when they go off to get you their drink or whatever.
There's also a great line at the end when the jig is up and you know, he says, I wish you'd come later. Well, she would have been dead. She would have been dead. And then Markham says, like she should have been for 16 years.
I know. There's absolutely no contrition in this guy. He's not saying to write. He's doped up his wife. Dahler has come in and he saved her. So, like, they're out. The guy's out with his girl and all that stuff. And Dahler goes back to the house to rescue this woman. So the guy comes home. And you know what this reminds me a little bit of is in Rear Window. When the bad guy, like, discovers, they watch him discover that something's missing. Except here, this all happens off stage. And I guess it sort of happens off stage in Rear Window, too. But we see it happening off stage, which is the whole point of Rear Window. And the guy just starts like, I guess once you've dug the hole, you might as well dig it a little deeper. I love how when Dahler goes to the door, too, like he tells the girl, now that the jig is up, and Eddie, to wait. Like, there's no drama that he's going to be knifed or shot or anything like that.
Right.
But he's so just weary that he has to go get the... You hear the weariness, that lassitude, even in his knock. And the guy answers the door, and like he knows he's caught. Dahler's like, I want you to come with me. And the guy, like you said, oh, why couldn't you come next week? And Dahler's like, she would have been dead. And the guy's like, you think like that's the last beat? The guy's like, she should have been dead for 16 years. Like, whoa, okay there, Mr. Yuck. Like, tone it down a little bit. But yeah, those details. It's the relationship between Dahler and Eddie that is like, you know how it is. When somebody steps outside of their world and gets caught up in somebody else's world, it's exciting. It's not the normal prosaic. So that's just, it's the relationships. You can build so much narrative just through conversation and relationship, and that really is what amplifies a plot.
Well, finally, and I feel we asked earlier if perhaps you were eavesdropping in the studio, the annoying noises that people make. Colin, I feel like this one might be aimed at me, and that's okay.
Oh, yeah, I forgot we were in this one. Did you read my little thing on the blog about the guy at the Starbucks?
Yes, yes, I did.
So, listeners, you non-blog readers, I'm at the Starbucks the other day, and there is this bro. He's like 28 years old, and he's with his girlfriend, and he's waiting for his drink order to be made. And he's just, like he's just moaning and groaning. Like, he's just come back from some epic Homeric battle or been up all night painting his masterpiece for the duration of the week. And he's wearing, like, these basketball shorts. He starts pulling them down. And you know how you get that little depression, that little declivity when you've reached Mound Pubis?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Well, that's where we're at.
Oh, my.
I'm thinking, oh, no. And he's just, I wanted to clock this guy, Kimball. Now, he also made me feel really good about myself because, like I said, he was 28. I'm thinking, like, look at this guy's fat face. And so I enjoyed that. I would take that for myself. But one of those things where it made me think about the noises people make. I'll give you an example of another one. When somebody buys their pack of cigarettes, it's like, okay, we get it. You're a badass smoker who's really packing that tight. When they do that little pack thing, right? That.
Oh, yes, like, yes. Okay. Yeah.
And then I'm not saying that somebody should be boiled alive for this, but if there was like a sort of noise-based consideration for boiling somebody alive, that sound that men make before they expectorate on the sidewalk, you know the sound I mean.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Is there anything more like just creepy and sort of vulgarish and just low class than that? I don't even want to try to replicate it.
No, no,
like,
thank you.
I hear this. It's like, why would you do that? Like, it's horrific.
I knew I was getting up there, and I thought, look, I'm in pretty good shape for a man of my advanced years, and I don't even know why I do this. It's subconscious, but I do it. I make the getting up out of the chair sounds.
How long you been doing that?
I don't know, but it happens, and occasionally
it was pointed out to you. Is that how you know? You
wouldn't. Oh yes. Well, I'll catch myself doing it, and I don't. I'm not even sure what prompts that. Or sometimes the sitting down and just, where the hell does that come from?
Maybe it smacks of what you think you deserve. Like, you've put in a good day.
You've done some
teaching of the youth. And you've been a great coach at Little League. And all of the things that you do. And you're just, it's your way of having a quiet, humble moment of self-congratulations. Because I've noticed it's a little bit different. But whenever I go near the sea and you get the whiff of the brine,
oh, yes.
I do let out a hearty arr, which probably drives people away from like my immediate remit. But it's just something it's my oneness with, granted, it's like the harbor right now, but it's my oneness with the brine. So that's my version of your But you know what? Like I said, this guy was probably 28, somewhere in that neighborhood. And really, you would have just thought he had come back from Nam like the day before and just jumped off the copter.
Colin Fleming. Listen, listeners, listener person right there, you, talking to you in your car. I see you there. When you go home, you need to go subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. We want those numbers to change in the next week. And then if you don't, I will pitch a fit of sorts right here next Tuesday when Colin returns.
And you don't want to see that, downtownians. You know his rage.
It's not pretty, and I will say there will be some sounds, and they will be irritating if that happens. In the meantime, Colin, have a great week, and we will check in with you next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming on Downtown, ColinFlemingLit.com, the Many Moments More blog.